It's 10:45. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. By the way, Kathleen will be on live from Washington, D.C. Next Monday morning. She's on the on that trip to Washington, D.C. with a lot of Wisconsin Public Radio listeners and supporters. And she'll be broadcasting live from the headquarters of National Public Radio in Washington and talking with Ken Rudin for all things political at 9 o'clock on Monday morning. And then in the second hour of the program on Monday, she'll have the director of the Smithsonian. Wow. I'm so jealous. Anyway, this hour, we have a great program here, and we're talking this half of the program with Daniel Gross, columnist and economics editor for Yahoo Finance. We're talking specifically about the gender discrimination suit brought against Walmart, the nation's largest retailer. We have a caller on the line, Jack, in Hayward. Let's hear what Jack has to say. Jack, good morning. Jack, are you there?
Yes, I'm calling from the car. I'm not sure I can hear you, but my question is that since Walmart is not franchised and all Walmart stores are under the headquarters, are under the Walmart headquarters, wouldn't that not be wouldn't that not be a stretch to for the headquarters to disavow any responsibility relative to the actions of the local managers?
Yeah, I think that's. Do you want me to take that?
Yes, please do.
Oh yeah, I think that is essentially what the plaintiffs are saying. They're saying, you know, decentralization is no excuse for poor conduct. But again, this case is not about saying whether they were guilty or innocent or whether discrimination happened. It's a question of, can it be certified as a class action that would then be open for, you know, all women who work at all Walmart stores to be part of, even if they, you know, hadn't filed suit on their own? And what the plaintiffs are saying is, hey, look, yes, you've got all these policies in place. You have, you know, as every company does, they have statements about we don't discriminate, and they may do education on that, et cetera. But if you're finding that at, you know, it's happening in a store in California and one in Mississippi and one in Oklahoma, and there's this sort of pervasive pattern, the conclusion might be that there is something about the company's culture or the way things are run that is encouraging this. If for example, you had a fast food chain where they could say, well, you know, we have independent managers or maybe independent owners, but you kept on having sort of violations of safety codes or health codes all over the place, you would be reasonable to conclude that there's something about the culture of this company, even though it has expressed policies about not violating the code, that there's something about the culture of the company that is leading people to do that and leading them to do it with impunity, and therefore, you know, you should be holding the whole company accountable, et cetera. So that is one of their explicit arguments, that it's, even if it's isolated or even if it's only in certain places, there are enough of these certain places that it tells us something about the culture of the place.
Let's take a call from Jody in Downing next.
Hi.
Jody, good morning.
I think it's interesting a comparison to what we're facing in Wisconsin right now with the governor, who we're not the only state, is basically doing union busting, taking workers' rights away, and Walmart has been a company that has never allowed unions in, and now they're facing this class action suit going to the Supreme Court, where they just gave the ruling that corporations, you know, basically can give whatever they want to campaign finance. So it's just an interesting time, and I guess I'd just like to hear your comments on that.
What about this? The Supreme Court hasn't been very friendly to workers in recent years.
Well, there was the, the Lilly Ledbetter case. This is the woman who is worked at Goodyear Tire, and this was some of the kind of crudest form of sexual, gender discrimination, harassment, and you know, the facts in that were just very ugly for Goodyear to wound its way through the system. And, you know, the Supreme Court essentially threw it out, basically saying that she had, you know, she was supposed to file within 180 days of the behavior that was problematic, and she didn't. She filed it 2 days later, and, you know, split decision, threw it out on a technicality, forcing, spurring Congress to pass a law saying that, you know, kind of expanding the window to do that, et cetera. So there have been cases where they have ruled against workers. I think this court, Supreme Court, is generally more pro-business than previous ones have been. And I think we are seeing, you know, not just at the Supreme Court, but as you said, in the state court in Wisconsin, you will see this in Ohio, these rulings on kind of very big organizations, very big employers, whether they're states, whether they're Walmart, and how they're treating employees. They are certainly spilling into various courtrooms.
Let's see. Let's hear from Tom in Menominee Falls next. Tom, good morning.
Hey, good morning, John. Can you hear me okay? I have a little trouble hearing you. I'm also on my cell phone here.
Yeah, I can hear you just fine. Go ahead.
Okay, I joined the conversation a little bit later here, so I apologize if I missed this. But my question for your guest this morning has to do with the fact that Judge Scalia's son, I believe, works for a law firm that basically does work on behalf of Walmart. You might say he's on retainer for Walmart. And I'm just basing this on my previous experience with having served on juries. I know when they do the jury selection, both sides go back and forth with their questioning, and they say, do you know either of the parties in this suit? Do you know either the prosecutor or the defense attorney and so forth? And I'm wondering if this isn't a gross conflict of interest to have Judge Scalia's son working on behalf of Walmart.
Right. So, you know, as you were posing that question, I'm sitting here in front of my computer and got on the Google. So his son is a partner and a member of the executive committee at Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher, which is a very large law firm. His name is Eugene Scalia. He's Antonin Scalia's son. And one of his colleagues has represented Walmart in the past. And essentially what he has done, going back several years, in 2003 apparently, he wrote a letter saying that he was going to disqualify himself, this was Eugene Scalia, the son, from any income that would come to him as a result of his partnership. In other words, he's saying, you know, if the partnership earned $10 million, but $1 million of that was from Walmart, that, you know, his payout in the partnership would only be based on that lower sum, and that he would therefore not be benefiting in any way, shape, or form from the fact that his firm represents Walmart. Now, you know, you can see that that is still problematic. You know, they're helping pay for their overhead. And I think this is something
well,
that...
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't see what difference that would make.
Confront time and again.
I don't see what difference that would make in terms of whether or not Justice Scalia should recuse himself. I mean, the money part of it, if his son is working for a law firm that does business with Walmart, there's, you know, that just seems, I don't know, that just seems kind of a slam dunk, but then maybe I'm just being stupid.
Apparently, the... you know, this sort of recusal that he has done seems to be good enough for Scalia. You know, Scalia is one of the most controversial judges out there. There are certainly groups that are, you know, picking up on everything he and Clarence Thomas are doing, and that there's family members are doing. You know, there's been a lot of controversy surrounding Clarence Thomas's wife, Ginny Thomas, who is a Tea Party activist and a lobbyist. And I think this is something that is sort of, you know, unavoidable because the, you know, people who are connected to elite people in our society tend to do things that are connected to other elite organizations, institutions, companies, and their cases, you know, come up before the court.
So what's the over-under on where the Supreme Court is going to come down on this class action decision?
I don't know. It's not, you know, on the one hand, there are sort of philosophical and legal issues, which I am not a huge expert on, but there are also gigantic logistical issues. One of the things that even, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was asking about is just, you know, how you go about constructing a class of this size, because, again, the number of people involved could be up to 1.5 million, and we just haven't had cases this large. And so I think part of, you know, in theory, the Supreme Court is supposed to be dealing with the high-flown questions of the law and constitutional rights, but they're also conscious that their rulings have real-world implications. And so there was some discussion about, you know, how this would actually sort of work, how you go about making something this big, what do you do with the employees, the women who are both potentially victims and the discriminators, how do you, you know, so there, that leads me to believe that the court is going to be, you know, sort of more careful than usual in approaching this decision. So the short answer is I really have no idea, and people who tell you how the court is going to rule generally, you know, are very easily confounded.
Where has the Obama administration been on this issue?
Well, this is not a, you know, this is a matter between two parties. It's the plaintiff's lawyers and Walmart's lawyers. This is not a situation where the government was suing. I do not believe this is an Equal Employment Opportunity Commission case. So they have not, to my knowledge, formally weighed in.
Probably a smart decision on their part. Walmart has, well, I mean, they were the retail juggernaut. They're still number one, but there are some cracks in the armor there. That's a company that their stock has remained rather stagnant. They're not quite as strong as they once were, are they?
Yeah, I think this is another one of the interesting things, how this sort of burst into the scene, because we really, I don't want to downplay Walmart's importance, but we don't really hear about them quite as much as we used to. If you dial back to 05 and 06 and 07, Walmart was, you know, they were still steamrolling through the country, plowing under all these mom-and-pop operations, hurting Main Street. They were this big bogeyman because, you know, they weren't giving health insurance, and they were responsible for low wages. There were reports about the number of Walmart employees who were on Medicaid. They were helping pushing, you know, manufacturing to China. You know, all these things. And a lot of that has gone away because, that stuff has already happened. Our manufacturing has already gone to China. They've already sort of had their effect on the local retailers, and their growth in the U.S. has really come to a halt. Their same-store sales, or the Walmart stores, were down in the most recent quarter. That's a function of, you know, they've saturated the places in the middle of the country, in the South, et cetera. Their customers aren't doing that well in the economy.
They have not been able to
penetrate New York. They are focusing, their biggest moves have been expanding in places like Chile and China and South Africa.
And we're going to have to leave it there, Daniel, because we're out of time. Daniel Gross, columnist and economics editor for Yahoo Finance. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.